And they realized pretty early on that there is one group of people who think about the weather all the time, they talk about the weather all the time, they are constantly checking it, and those are farmers. And so we very quickly shifted from looking at weather risk for all industries, and we moved into agriculture and really focused on how can we help people protect themselves against various weather events. And the way that we did that was by using predictive modeling. And so that's a lot of what I'm going to talk about today. Now, once you build these predictive models that tell you what you think your yield is going to look like given various weather events throughout the season, it's a very obvious step from there to move into making recommendations, right? We think this is what your weather is going to look like, and here's how it impacts your yield, and here are things that you can do to mitigate that risk. And so I'm going to focus today on our decision support tools, and I'm going to talk about nitrogen management in particular. Okay, so I'm going to start with data science and agriculture, which is obviously why we're all here today. All of us believe in this. I'm then going to move on to the power of models. So how do we create our decision agriculture tools, and what sort of models are we looking at? And then finally, I'm going to talk about using measurements to really drive these models. And for both of the last two parts of the talk, I'll really focus on nitrogen management. So as everyone here, I'm sure, is very aware, world population is growing. And obviously, as world population grows, the need for food grows as well. But it's not just that population is growing and so we need to increase yields. It's also that as countries become wealthier, people change their eating habits, and so per capita consumption also goes up. So this is a story that probably all of you have heard. It's one of the things that I believe is really driving precision agriculture today. And there are many studies, this is just one in particular, but there are many studies that support this general idea, which is that if yields increase at the rate that they are expected to increase, they're not going to increase fast enough to support both the increase in population and the increase in demand caused by people sort of changing consumption patterns. So in this particular study, the solid line represents sort of the projection of increase for some of the major crops internationally. And the dotted line is what the expected demand is. And as you can see, in most cases, that demand is much higher than the expected or believed increase in yield. And in this particular study, which again is just an example, there are many studies like this out there, this particular study suggested that crop production actually has to increase by 60% to meet demand by 2050. And so that's why I think all of us more or less are here today. So everyone knows probably the first two parts of this story. We can talk about the Green Revolution. So everyone here knows that Norman Borlaug is considered to, or he's often given the nickname, the man who saved a billion people. And he did that by using smart breeding, right? So he bred crops that had higher yield and that were naturally resistant. And he also encouraged people to use fertilization practices, right? And so between these two things, really, yield increased worldwide. And then we move to the second phase of the agricultural revolution, and that's really the biotech revolution, right? So we're still talking about breeding, but now we're using very high-tech solutions to enable breeding. Right? So we can make the breeding pipeline faster, we can make yield increases from breeding come to market much sooner, and we can also introduce traits, right, into seeds. The third revolution is the one that we're just starting right now, right? And this is really the green data revolution. And the idea is taking all of these techniques that statisticians and machine learners have developed and have applied very successfully to many other fields, and really applying them to agriculture. So instead of having people who are trying to automatically detect faces in images, we have people who think about automatically detecting crops in an image of a field, right? And instead of people thinking about clicks on a website, well, we focus on ag instead. And one of the ideas here that that I'm going to focus on is using data science to really help people optimize their decision making, right? So there are a lot of decisions that growers make throughout the season, and by bringing together all of the data that they have available to them, and a lot of this data you guys have been seeing all day long, so we use all of this data to help them make decisions that we think are going to enable them to have higher yields. So the way that we do this, and obviously there are many, many different ways to try to do this, but the approach that we've taken is by building predictive models of yield. Now this is a very high level equation, right? But the idea is we want to understand yield as a function of genetics. So what seed are you buying? What seed are you planting? Environment. So this is your field environment, right? This might be characteristics of your field. So do you have good soil or bad? What's the topography of your field look like? What are various field characteristics? But this is also weather, right? Your field experiences different weather in different seasons. And your field and this weather interact in various ways. And then finally, practices. So as I said, growers make a lot of decisions. When should I plant? When should I fertilize? Should I irrigate or not? When should I irrigate and how much? And of course, these three factors, genetics, environment, and practices, these aren't independent things, right? Your environment is going to influence your genetics. So the same genetics might behave in different ways under different environmental conditions. And similarly, practices are going to be affected by both environment and genetics. And I'll talk about that a lot more later in the talk. And then finally, because I'm a statistician, if I want to create a model of yield, I of course have some variability in my model, and this is natural variability. That's not associated with the variability from your genetics, your environment, and your practices. But that's not the only source of variability here, right? There's variability in my environment. So if I think about weather, and I'm a grower, I can have a weather station at my farm. But of course, that measurement isn't going to be perfect, right? There's error related to it. The same thing is true if I try to sample some of my field properties. When I take those samples, there are errors associated with that measurement. And again, this is something I'll discuss later in my talk. And of course, practices, right? This is a big one that a lot of times we don't think about, but it's hugely important. So if I own a piece of equipment, and that equipment's ability to precisely plant or to precisely apply fertilizer is low, well, that means that my field has to have pretty high variability in terms of what is a good planting density for it or what is a good nutrient rate in order to make that product worthwhile, right? Because if the differences that I'm seeing in sort of the optimal levels are very small, and your equipment can't handle that, well, then there's no point in creating a variable product. Okay, so this is what we're trying to do, right? This curve over here represents a distribution of yield outcomes. When you choose seed where people have really spent years trying to optimize that seed, they've added traits to it, the genetics are pretty much optimized for your field, but you're using traditional management practices. And the idea is that we go back to this equation, we look at the genetics that you're using, we look at the environment that your seed is experiencing, and then we can change this last term, we can update your practices to really try to shift this yield distribution to the right. And in doing so, this is where we think that we're actually going to make a difference. So at a very high level, this is what we're focused on doing. We're focused on understanding how yield is related to these factors, and then using this model to make recommendations about specific practices or specific genetics to shift your yield to the right. So I'm going to talk about a very specific example now. And in particular, I'm going to talk about nitrogen management. So that's been a pretty popular topic here. We'll see if I can add anything to it. Some of you who work with corn have probably seen this website before. So this is a list of sort of the 7 most important factors if you grow corn. And the first one up there is weather. Now, there's not a lot that growers can actually do about their weather. There are some ways that they can try to mitigate that risk. So, for example, they choose when to plant if they're trying to mitigate that risk. But once the seed is planted, there's not that much you can do. You might be able to irrigate, but for a lot of growers, there are limited decisions to make regarding your weather once that seed is in the ground. The second factor on the list is nitrogen, right? So nutrients. Everything after that, of course, you're also talking about various management and decision practices, and they're not necessarily independent of the second one again, right? So your previous crop and your hybrid and your tillage decisions, all of these things actually go back into your nutrient management as well. So that's one of the reasons why I want to focus on nitrogen for this particular talk. Now, any of you who have done a Google search or a Google Scholar search should find this image to be pretty familiar. This is just one particular study. I think it was done in Wisconsin. And so, but the general idea and the general shape that we're seeing here is pretty common. You can take pretty much any study of nitrogen use and look at crop yield and applied nitrogen, and you're going to see a very, very similar shape. Right? And so growers they've either seen this or they know it intuitively, right? They're familiar with this idea that, look, if you don't apply enough, you're going to see really big impacts on your yield, which obviously they don't want. You can apply a lot, and it doesn't necessarily make much difference. But there's a big risk factor to underapplication. Now, the question that growers want to know is, well, how much do I need to apply? They know that they need to apply every season. They also know that the amount of nitrogen they need to apply is influenced by lots of factors, right? It's influenced by management practices. So if you rotate crops, if you're planting corn on soy as opposed to corn on corn, your fertilizer needs are going to be different. It's influenced by residue management, right? And it's also influenced by weather. So I'm going to go ahead and dig a little more into this last one. This is a very partial diagram of the nitrogen cycle. And I'm really focusing here on nitrogen mobility, right? So everyone knows that nitrogen is extremely mobile. And a lot of this is related to weather. So you apply fertilizer. And let's say you're applying something like UAN or urea. One thing that can happen is you apply that fertilizer and you lose some of it due to volatilization, right? Another thing that can happen is your fertilizer gets converted into ammonium, maybe gets converted into nitrate, and then you have a big rain event. And so some of this nitrate gets lost deeper into the soil layers where the roots can't uptake it anymore due to leaching, right? But you can also lose nitrate due to denitrification, and this happens in flooded conditions. So again, if you have these big rainstorms and your field is flooded for a couple of days, you're going to lose some nitrate. And growers know this. They know that there are a lot of ways that the fertilizer that they apply can be lost to the system. And the only one that they actually want to happen is this one right here, right? It's the crop uptake. The growers apply fertilizer, and they want all of that fertilizer to be uptaken by their crop. And what they don't know is how much is actually being lost through these various other avenues. But obviously, that's going to affect how much they need to apply, right? The more losses they have, the more they're going to need to apply. Okay, so then what's the problem with overapplication? So if we go back here, there doesn't really seem to be much difference in yield, whether you apply a lot or, you know, slightly less. So why not just apply more and hope that you've applied enough, and if you applied a little bit too much, it doesn't really seem to matter in terms of your yield. Well, there are two problems with it. One of them is really a local problem, right? So this is a particular study that was done measuring nitrogen in surface waters in Minnesota. On the left-hand side, all of these little dots represented rivers and streams that were sampled, and the color tells you what the concentration of nitrate was in milligrams per liter. And the important thing to note here is these red dots. Okay, so 10 milligrams per liter is the EPA's limit, their safe recommendation for drinking water. So anything that's 10 and above means that your local water system really has too much nitrate in it. Another group did a similar study that looked at well water, right? And they sampled a number of independent wells throughout the state. And again, they were looking at which ones are safe and then which ones are above the limit. And as you can see, there are quite a few here that are above this limit that's imposed by the EPA, right? So we have this local problem of, well, if we apply too much, this nitrate can leach out into our drinking water. And then that's really expensive for us to deal with. But there's also a larger problem with this as well. And it's related to the fact that 41% of the contiguous U.S. Really drains into the Mississippi. And if you look at this, not only is that a huge amount of land, but this is also a huge amount of land that covers many, if not all, of our corn-producing states. Right? So over-applying fertilizer in Minnesota is not just a problem for Minnesota. That over-application moves into rivers and then moves down into the Gulf of Mexico. So this is a really, I think this is a really interesting picture. What you're seeing here is this fresh water. So you have lots of nutrients, lots of sediment in this fresh water. So this is the fresh water that is draining from places like Minnesota and moving into the Gulf. And it's meeting with and mixing with this very nutrient and sediment poor salt water. And one thing, of course, that can happen when you have too many nutrients is hypoxia, right? So all of you are, of course, familiar with this, but I'll review it really quickly. You have fresh water that's flowing into the Gulf. It's very nutrient-rich. You have algae that feeds on the nutrients in this fresh water. They grow. They are consumed by plankton. These then die. And they're broken down by bacteria, and in the process, what you get is a depletion of oxygen in the water. And the reason why we care about this is that when you have this really oxygen-depleted water, you have marine life that either dies because it can't live in such an oxygen-depleted state, or it moves away from the Gulf. And that impacts a lot of other that has an economic impact on the entire Gulf, right? That impacts people who fish for a living. And so it's a pretty large impact, right, if you think about it, from applying nitrogen on your farm all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, agricultural runoff is not the only source of nitrogen in the Mississippi, which is going into the Gulf. But if you, and if you're interested, I suggest you read this this report. So this particular report on the causes of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico says that while information gaps still exist and several factors may contribute to hypoxia, the overwhelming scientific evidence indicates that excess nitrogen from the Mississippi River drainage basin coupled with hydrologic and climatic factors drives the onset and duration of hypoxia in the northern Gulf of Mexico. So this is not just our problem, but we are certainly contributing to it. So now if we go back and we look at just Minnesota again, if we're looking at sources contributing to, so in this case, we're not just talking about nitrate now we're talking about all forms of nitrogen, including organic forms. But if you look at sources just from Minnesota, you see that wet years are contributing substantially more than sort of average and dry years. But most of the contribution, regardless of the weather, is really coming from agricultural lands. And this trend that you see in Minnesota is also seen when you look at the entire Mississippi Basin, which is that agricultural non-point sources are contributing, are estimated to contribute 74% of nitrate and 65% of the total nitrogen in the water. So this is a problem not just locally, not just for people drinking the water, but this is a problem for the entire economy. And so I would argue that because of this fact, and because of what I mentioned earlier, right, we know that we need to increase production of crop yields. We have to do that if we want to support the number of people we are projected to have in the future without bringing in substantially more land to be farmed. So I would argue that really fertilizer application and nitrogen practices are a very good candidate for precision agriculture. And I think a lot of people agree with this because there have been a number of talks today about this specific thing. And in particular, you want to optimize against three types of practices, right? So some people apply in the fall. One of the potential problems with applying in the fall is that if you have a very wet fall or a very wet spring, you can lose a lot of that, again, to leaching or to denitrification. There are also spring applications. And then some people do split applications, right? So they do a pre-planting and then they do a side dressing in the middle of the season. So you want to optimize across all of these different types of applications. And you also need to optimize the amount, right? So you only want to recommend, you want to really recommend the minimum amount needed to ensure high revenue. So you want to reduce leaching and you want to reduce other losses. Now notice I said you want to ensure high revenue. So I'm actually going to argue that what we want to do here is really provide the economically optimal fertilizer application. And the reason why we want to provide an economically optimal fertilizer application is that that's really going to balance this idea of producing very high yields but keeping over-application to a minimum, right, and reducing losses. So that's what I'm going to focus on. Now, that's a big problem, right? There are three different types of applications. You have to think about how much should people be applying, when should they be applying, which of these types of applications really makes sense for where they live, the weather that they're expected to have. And so we said, okay, well, let's take a step back and let's start a little simpler. And so we started by just looking at side dressing applications. So you tell us what you've done up until today, and what we'll do is we will think about, we'll look at the weather that you're expected to have and the weather you've already had. We'll look at your nutrient needs, and we'll recommend a side dressing application that, again, is gonna ensure high revenue and try to minimize these other losses. So our goal was really to provide this economically optimal side dressing application amount and the date. So when do you apply and how much do you apply? And so that's what we started with. So we created what we call an Action Advisor. This is part of our Climate Pro product line. And for the first year, we said, okay, let's keep it at field level. So this is sort of your typical field condition. Let's make a model that responds to daily weather events as opposed to monthly or something else. So every day we take into account the weather that you've had, the growth of your crop, and your crop's nutrient needs. And we try to figure out how much nutrients the crop is going to need for the rest of the season, and whether or not you need to apply anything else. And we also said, let's make the model conservative. So why make the model conservative? Well, at the very, toward the very beginning of this talk, I said we model yield as a function of all these other factors, right? And there's a lot of variability in yield. And so one of the ways that you can deal with this variability is by creating a tool that accounts for the variability inside your recommendation. This tool is also site-specific. So it uses soil properties from the grower's field. It uses weather, high-resolution weather data. And we ask for growers' management decisions and management practices. And so we take that into account as well. All right, so how does this work? As I mentioned before, we have high-resolution weather data. The grower provides us with information about their practices, so what type of fertilizer do they typically use when they side dress? That was not expected. Apparently I'm supposed to order dinner now. Let's maybe not do that and go back to here. Okay, grower practices. So we want to know information like the information I told you before, right? What are your practices? What did you plant last season? Tell us about your tillage and other factors that may influence how much nitrogen your crop actually needs. All of these factors then go into a physical model that looks at how much nitrogen is actually available in the soil to your crop throughout the entire season. That information then goes into a revenue model, right? So by knowing how much nitrogen is available in your soil to your crop throughout the entire season, we can estimate what your yield and your revenue will be at the end of the season. And once we have that, we can then go back and figure out what the optimal side dressing amount and timing was. So that's what provides a grower with a recommendation. And one of the interesting things about creating a tool like this is because all of these are based on predicted models, you can then go back and you can ask questions about counterfactual situations. So what would have happened if I had engaged in this practice in a specific season? Or what would have happened this year if I engaged in this practice? And so I want to spend just a little bit of time right now looking at some of that. So we can look at the impact of practices, for example. What I've done here is I have run our model for 3 different years. So one of them was 2008, one was 2012, and one was this year. Right? 2008 was, or the fall of 2007, was a very wet fall. So there was... this is a pretty good year if you want to understand sort of what happens when you have a really wet fall. And of course, 2012 was a pretty dry year in most places. So in this particular example, what I'm looking at is over winter leaching losses. And I'm assuming that in all 3 of these cases, I applied 120 pounds per acre of anhydrous ammonia on the 15th of November. And then these two show the losses that you would expect relative to this year. So relative to if you had applied that amount in this particular year. And so you can use this to understand in a wet year, how much more nitrogen do you lose? Or in a dry year, how much less do you lose due to these conditions? And this can help you understand whether a fall application makes sense, right, for a particular grower or for a particular region. And you can also look at the impact that you would have on your recommendation, right? So this is a side dressing recommendation. Here, I know that the colors are probably a little bit backwards, but red here means that you are recommended to apply less. Green means you're recommended to apply more. And again, the recommendations are relative to what we would recommend for 2014. And so you see you really see here the impact of having that very, very wet fall in 2007, because it makes a big difference in what we're recommending that you need to apply in the spring after you've planted, right? You've lost so much over the winter that you really need to apply quite a bit more. And of course, these recommendations are specifically for UAN 30. So if you chose a different type of fertilizer, you would see a slightly different graphic, but the idea is that you see very similar patterns because you've lost quite a bit in 2008. And then you can also look at what happens if you apply, say, in the fall versus if you apply in the spring, right? So I have 3 years. So I have 2008, 2012, and 2014. For one of them, I used the exact same scenario that I talked about in the last two slides, which is I'm applying 120 pounds per acre of anhydrous ammonia on the 15th. And then I compare that to what if I didn't apply anything in the fall at all? What if I only applied in the spring? So what if I applied on April 15th, for example? And you can see in different years how your recommendation changes. So in some years and in some places, there's no difference because there's not a huge change. You don't see big losses over the winter. In some areas, you see huge differences, right? So 2008, again, this is a really wet year. 2012 was a really dry year for most parts. So you see big differences here. So the next thing that I want to talk about is measurements. So I've talked about modeling. You can create these models, you can use these models to understand what happens under different weather conditions, what happens with different management practices. But one of the issues with models, of course, is that your models are sort of only as good as your data. And I'm a statistician, and so I can use messy data and noisy data, and there are a lot of techniques for trying to get signal out of really noisy data. But obviously, the better your data is, well, the better your model is, right? So again, I'm going to continue focusing on nitrogen management. So as I said earlier, your fertilizer requirements are sensitive to a number of factors, right? Obviously, there's weather and management decisions. But it's also sensitive to some of your soil properties, right? So one example is how much organic matter is in your soil. Do you have soils that are really rich, or do you have soils that are really poor? And so if you have a good model of nitrogen processes, right, it should also be sensitive to all of these factors, right? And what that means is that we need to get the best data possible for these factors in order to get the best sense of what is actually happening in that field. Okay, so I'm going to focus for the rest of the talk on soil data. And at least some of you in this room are probably familiar with soil surveys. Soil surveys are great because they're readily available, but they can have some problems. So they can be subjective, and it's sometimes the case that you don't have a lot of measurements. So this, of course, makes perfect sense. It is expensive to go out in the field and collect a bunch of samples. So you go out in the field and you collect some number of samples, and then you do some sort of interpolation, and you produce a product. So if you didn't want to use a soil survey, you might say, okay, well, let's go ahead and sample then. So let's talk about sampling. This is, to me, a really interesting, and as a statistician, really disturbing measure. So here's what happened. There are tests in which the same sample is sent to many different labs all over the country, and you get back these reports that show for a bunch of different labs, what did they report as being, in this particular case, the amount of potassium in the sample. And if you look at, for some of these, the high estimate and the low estimate, you see a pretty big discrepancy here, right? There's a huge amount of variability in what labs are reporting in samples. And so this is a problem, right? Because this huge variability, well, if you get a soil sample back, and now let's think about nitrate for a minute. If you get a soil sample back that says your nitrate levels are really high, well, then you're not going to fertilize as much. But if that's a false measurement, right? If your nitrate levels aren't actually as high as it's being reported, you might end up under-fertilizing, and you're going to then suffer some sort of yield loss. On the other side, there are these very low readings, right? And again, if you get your nitrate measurement back and it says, oh, your soil is really, really low, it's really depleted, you're going to go out and add a ton of fertilizer to your field because that's what the measurement is telling you to do. But your field might not actually need that much. And so again, we're back in the situation where we're over-applying and we're contributing to all of these sort of negative environmental consequences. And so this is where Solem comes in. And Solem is a soil lab that we purchased in December, I believe. And what they're really focused on is trying to remove this variability, right? So they have really thought about making substantial process improvements, right? So identifying where errors are coming from, making sure that they fix them, and as a result, they have much, much lower variability in the samples that they produce. And so this is important to us, right? Because it means that this is data that we have good reason to believe is reliable, and that isn't going to be sort of too far away from what we believe the truth is. Oh, yes, this one was lots of different labs, right? So each of these points represents a different lab. So it's the same sample being sent out many, many different places. Some labs are consistently high, some labs are consistently low. Doing the same experiment, at Solem, it was a blind experiment, so the people running the samples did not know that they were part of the experiment. They were much closer to what the actual true value was. And this is something that is done, right? This type of approach, this really, I guess, continual development, to ensure that the samples that you run are very high quality, that you get the same results over and over again, that's part of what drives this particular lab. So going back to my example for Nitrogen Advisor, and of course, this is a soil lab, so this is not the only thing that they do, but I'm going to focus on two things that are important for understanding nitrogen and improving on nitrogen recommendations. And one of those is in-season nitrate measurements. So one of the things that they've developed is what they call their no-weight nitrate machine. And if you're ever in San Francisco, our headquarters are in San Francisco, we have one of these right by our entryway, so you can bring your own soil sample in if you'd like. We can run it for you, just in case you're curious. The idea here is that it's a mobile unit, so it's easy to take out into the field. And by getting back these in-season nitrate measurements, right, we can assimilate this into a model in the middle of the season, right? So we can use it in the middle of the season to calibrate our model and make the model more aligned with what we've actually measured is happening in the field. And we can do that pretty seamlessly so that the grower has a better user experience, essentially. But they're also looking at measuring physical properties, right? And so measuring things like soil moisture and soil texture, these are also really important if you want to understand available nitrogen in the soil. So at the very beginning, when I talked about nitrogen being mobile, the uptake of nitrogen, for example, depends on soil moisture. So if you don't have enough moisture in your soil, right, your crop isn't going to uptake any nutrients. So again, this is a case where having in-season moisture measurements, that can be used to process and to calibrate the model while the grower is using the tool. And the idea that we are really pursuing right now is to create basically a next generation sort of servo by using all of our measurement capabilities. And so these, unfortunately, are not as mobile. All of these processes are available from the soil lab that's physically located in Ames. But the idea is that between the two of these, we get these very high quality measurements. We use them in the model to update the grower's information in the middle of the season, and this is completely seamless to the grower. The grower doesn't have to tell us this information. We can get it directly from our soil labs. All right, so I think I'm running out of time at this point. Yeah, I have about 15 minutes left, and I want to leave some time for questions. So my goal today was to try to convince you that that fertilizer practices are a really, really good sort of use of precision agriculture, and that moreover, one of the best ways to approach this is by using predictive modeling, but that predictive models really need very high quality measurements if you want to make them as accurate as possible. And so this is a sponsored talk, so I promised our recruiting team that I would point out that we are hiring. So if anybody is interested, you can email recruiting@climate.com. And if you have questions, you can ask them either now or you can send me an email as well. That's all I have to do.